for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. When Edith Wharton's novel Ethan Frome was first published in 1911, reviews were largely negative. Critics called the story cruel and violent, and sales of the novel were dismal. Today, Edith Wharton's haunting tale of forbidden romance in a rural New England town is her most widely read novel. Joining me for this month's reader's review of Ethan Frome, Lisa Page of the Penn Faulkner Foundation, John Fordrescher of Georgetown University, and Meredith Goldsmith of Ursinus College. I hope you'll join us. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. Meredith Goldsmith, I neglected to say, you are vice president of the Edith Wharton Society. This is quite a novel. John Fordrescher, tell us who Ethan Frome is. What do we learn about him during this tragic story?
So the story is told in two time frames. Begins in what might be thought of as the present, around 1911. And the narrator tells us that he's the most striking figure in this small town in Massachusetts, even though he's a ruin of a man. So the novel is, in a sense, an exploration of how he reached this ruinous state, his physical size and his inner strength, which the narrator recognizes right away, makes for a compelling puzzle. What has happened to this fellow? And that's what the novel then unfolds.
Lisa Page, why does the novelist use an anonymous narrator for this book?
I think that position as outsider coming into this terribly bleak place sets things up so that as an outsider he can present the characters and introduce them in an intimate way. As he gets to know them, the reader gets to know them.
So he brings us into the life of Ethan Frome. Rather, is that, you know, a literary trick?
Well, I think so. I mean, clearly, it's in first person. It's opening up with this personal rendition of events, as opposed to once upon a time, Ethan Frome lived in the wintry.
Yeah.
It's much more personal.
Interesting. And Meredith Goldsmith, how unusual a novel was this for Edith Wharton?
It is pretty unusual. Wharton's first few novels, like The House of Mirth, that people might be familiar with, are sort of novels of manners, novels of sort of high New York society. And then while living in New England, she was observing a lot of New England rural poverty, essentially. And that led to the novel The Fruit of the Tree in 1908, which is about the situation in the mills in rural New England. And then while living in Lenox, she found this story. And so this is one of three novels about New England.
What do you mean she found this story?
Well, she heard a story of this sledding accident in which I believe one woman was killed and two others severely injured. And so she decided to use it, as she often found germs of her stories.
I can remember years and years ago seeing this film with Sterling Hayden. I shall never forget it as long as I live, because you jumped ahead to the sledding accident, which is the culmination of this story. But did she see, as she was living in Massachusetts, people like Ethan Frome?
Absolutely. One of the things that Wharton said about her New England writing is that she wanted to sort of reverse the stereotypes that other New England local color writers were creating of a sort of, a kind of kinder, gentler, sanitized New England.
What was going on in her own life at the time?
Well, I think part of what's going on in Ethan Frome that's related to her own life is that she was in a very unhappy marriage and had been estranged from her husband for years, who'd also been mentally ill. She was essentially supporting him. So she was very much locked in a caretaker role and had also had an affair, which was really the first time she'd had a happy relationship, apparently. But that didn't seem to have a future either.
Did she marry into a wealthy family, or did she have her own wealth to begin with?
She had very much her own wealth. She was one of the wealthiest women in New York in the mid-19th century, and her family came from the family from whom the term keeping up with the Joneses was apparently coined.
I love that.
Yeah.
And the man she married, what was he like?
Apparently, you know, a sort of apparently a gentleman, but then a sort of dissolute aristocrat who apparently drank, may have been fooling around with other women, and just had a lot of ultimately had a lot of problems.
Okay, and this brings us to Matty, John Ford Drescher. How does she come to work for the Fromes?
Well, money is involved in this novel all the time. Maddie's father has suffered severe economic reverses, and then both her father and her mother die. Isn't that right? Mm-hmm. And she's sort of thrown onto her cousins as an unwanted dependent, and they send her off to Ethan and his wife,
Zena. Nobody wants her.
Nobody wants her, no. And she she seems to be sweet, tender and affectionate, but not very effective. And Zena, Ethan's wife, is always faulting her because, from Zena's point of view, she's not a good caregiver or housekeeper.
Zena strikes me as perfect example of a hypochondriac, Lisa.
I think that's dead on. I think she is a hypochondriac. But I will say, even as she's really the villain in a lot of ways in this story, I found her sympathetic as well.
How so?
Well, because I think she sees what's happening between Maddie and Ethan. I think they're both clearly quite taken with each other. Maddie Silver's not paying attention to Zena, who needs all this care. And she breaks her best china. She, you know, they're having a great time while she's upstairs in bed. And I think that's
honestly rough. I think that's overstating it. When you say they're having a great time, I think this is a novel of repression. Repression in almost a violent state. I mean, I can feel Ethan Frome breathing. He's so muscularly constrained because he's loyal to his wife, and yet he loves this young woman, John.
And I think there's a crucial word in the middle of the story, which is mastery.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of one of the chapters, Ethan has been speaking very firmly to Maddie. And he suddenly feels, this is what you're talking about, Dan, he suddenly feels a kind of wonderful inner glow because he's mastered Maddie. And then, of course, in the very next chapter, the revenge of Zena is to master him. And he realizes that she's mastered him. So there's a struggle for dominance in this claustrophobic, impoverished New England farmhouse, where the two women and the man sit all day struggling against each other.
Meredith.
But I want to sort of go back to the question of the narrator here. You know, I think it's important that we're only hearing this through the narrator's perspective of Ethan's story, which is essentially to kind of villainize Zena,
yes,
heroize Ethan, and I don't know, charm turn Maddie into this sort of charming little creature. And I think because of that narrative perspective, it's hard for us to see that there may be more going on there. And I think that that does have to do with what Zena's seeing and observing of the marriage that she went into with a different set of aspirations that's no longer there.
Shouldn't we back up even further to the fact that initially Zena cared for Ethan's mother, right, who was sickly at the beginning of the novel?
Absolutely. I mean, I think Zena came into this situation as the caretaker. And what we see when she was taking care of Ethan's mother is, in a way, she set Ethan free. You know, there's a line where Wharton says, you know, Ethan hadn't known what it was like to sort of go out with the guys, you know, until Zena came into the household. And then he married her. And Zena was someone who wanted to get out. She, you know, she had a desire for a different kind of life. And then she settles into this sort of bleak situation where she's now Ethan's helpmeet, essentially.
Why does Zena decide to marry Ethan?
Well, I mean, again, she's taking care of the mother,
right,
initially, and Ethan admires her facility,
yeah,
with taking care,
mm-hmm,
of the mother,
true,
only to learn later that she's so good at it because she studied her own illnesses. But initially, it just seems like a natural. It just one thing leads to another.
She's also 7 years older, yeah, than Ethan. So her marital chances are waning.
Yeah.
So how does, does Ethan, as soon as he lays eyes on Maddie, does he fall in love, John?
I think so. He gets her at the train, picks her up, right? And even bringing her back, that begins. I find it interesting how the novel figures her. Our attention is drawn to certain aspects of her, her hair, her mouth, and then other aspects we don't get.
Short break. Right back. That's the number to call if you'd like to join us as we talk about Edith Wharton's long-lasting novel, Ethan Frome, which has been made into 2 Hollywood productions. The first I saw with Sterling Hayden. I have no idea who played the female leads. And then there was a second, more recent film. Who was that starring Meredith?
Liam Neeson.
Liam Neeson, absolutely. Here's a posting on Facebook from Laura. She says, I'm a longtime listener, now living in the Middle East. I have 2 questions. Number one, what is the significance of Edith Wharton's choice to not disclose the gender of the narrator in the book? And number 2, Maddie said she liked Ethan because he was nice to her. But Dennis, the young man who's courting Maddie, was also nice mm-hmm. to her. Why did she choose Ethan instead of Dennis when Dennis had a better future? Lisa.
Okay, first question. I think that the gender is revealed because the narrator has come to work on the power company.
Absolutely.
And in those days, women didn't do that.
Right.
Number one. Number two, in terms of the second question, could you repeat that one more time?
Maddie said she liked Ethan because he was nice to her, but Dennis was also nice to her. So why did she choose Ethan over Dennis?
Well, Ethan is so plugged into Maddie. It's just from the minute he sees her. She's the light where there was always darkness.
Yeah.
She's the warmth where it was always cold. Any woman's going to respond to that.
It's an interesting question, though, because there is obviously that alternative that she turns away from, because Dennis would have been a good provider. The Irish who are running this shop down in town make good money and become more and more prosperous as time passes. Had she married him, she would have had a nice meal ticket.
But was he less attentive, less absorbed in her?
I think Dennis just sees her as a kind of another charming girl. But I do have some more thoughts on this, though. If we think that there's some tension between Maddie and Zena, which I think there is, you know, Maddie's been brought there as the poor relation, essentially. Zena has what Maddie doesn't. She has this man, you know, and so I think that there's some competition and rivalry there.
Here's another comment on Facebook from John, who says, I read the book for a high school English class. Apart from hating any book set in New England, I found no sympathy whatsoever for the characters in the book. And found the whole, I'm not going to even read this until we get a little later into the book. I want to ask you, Lisa, about the New Yorker piece by Jonathan Franzen about Edith Wharton.
Yes, in last week's New Yorker, Jonathan Franzen has done an essay. It's celebrating the 150th anniversary of Edith Wharton. And he talks about sympathy, as your this Facebook thing just said. But he talks about sympathy around Edith Wharton herself, that she couldn't have sympathy because she was such a wealthy woman, because she wasn't an attractive woman. And he also talks about the sympathy generated around her characters and whether she indeed had sympathy for her own characters, particularly when they were pretty women. He kind of jumps around quite a bit, and it's received quite a bit of attention now. There's an organization in New York called Word of Mouth that is actively pushing to send letters to the editor at The New Yorker around this.
Were you offended by it?
Yes.
Why?
I found his depiction of Edith Wharton simplistic. And rather one-dimensional, frankly, the wealthy woman who's leaving her pages of manuscript for the maid to pick up while she lies in bed writing. You know, there have been an awful lot of male writers who have had money and had wives to pick up their pages. And I just found that, and I'm a fan of Franzen's, but I found that outrageous.
Meredith.
I have to agree. I mean, first of all, I have to say, Edith Wharton was a pretty attractive woman. just to address the question of about Wharton's not being pretty, you should see. I mean, Wharton was a debutante.
Yeah.
So I think that argument is not only problematic in a number of ways, but also pretty selective. And then I think we have to distinguish between who Wharton was as a person, whom she socialized with, the kind of family she came from, and so on, and her imagination. Because the sheer fact that she creates this book and tries to enter into the lives of these characters who are very, very different from her, I think suggests an ability to empathize.
But at the same time, how much of this novel do you see as perhaps autobiographical?
Definitely some. We've talked about that a little bit already, the fact that Wharton was trapped in this marriage. There's also, something that has to do with the fact that both, you know, Wharton had suffered a breakdown, Teddy had suffered a breakdown,
her husband,
Fullerton was ailing. So this issue of, you know, illness, mental illness, the attention that sick people receive and that they have to be given, I think that was something that was very much on her mind.
John Ford Redditor, do you think that men reading this novel perceive it somewhat differently?
Well, I think it's a very curious question. We've talked about this a bit already. The male, presumably male narrator, looking at this story of tragic suffering, I think sees it from a very male perspective. And you talked earlier about Ethan being trapped inside of this passionate life that he lives. And I think men read that and think they understand it. But it would seem to me that there's a bit of Edith Wharton in all of her major characters, that I can see her in some ways as like Zena, because she had an unfaithful husband. I can see her as perhaps yearning to be the Maddie who would be sort of addressed. Yeah, adored. That's the word. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And it's quite common, I think, for really powerful writers to see bits and pieces of their inner life in many of the characters they create.
Meredith.
I think that also takes us to the role of Mrs. Hale, you know, who's observed what's going on.
Tell us who Mrs. Hale is.
Mrs. Hale is a sort of older woman that the narrator meets when he comes to the town, and she's his landlady while he's staying here to do this project. And he learns that she's the one who's, in fact, found Maddie and Ethan after the accident, and she's taken care of them. And in the prologue and epilogue of the story, he's sort of trying to press her to find out what actually happened. And she reveals at the end some of the things that she's observed, which were essentially too painful to talk about in the entire narrative that's preceded it.
But also Mrs. Hale, who was a young woman the same age as Maddie Silver, has had love that where she married the person she was in love with. She hasn't had to struggle in secret the way that Maddie has, and she hasn't had her own life end in tragedy. So they sort of play off of each other.
Yeah. She's the foil.
Yes.
She's the healthy one. I think the name is a pun. Hale and Hardy.
Interesting. Well,
but she's the foil, but she also, she's observed something really profound, you know, because she's the one who said after they found Maddie's body, you know, I say it's a pity that she lived, you know, which is, I think, a very shocking revelation.
All right, we're there. Let's talk about this sleigh ride. There is a huge elm tree at the bottom of the hill. It's described earlier in the book. And Ethan Frome says there could be accidents there. And what happens?
Well, it's the day that Maddie's being driven out, and Ethan's taking her to the train.
Zena has said, I don't want anything to do with her anymore.
She has mastered them both, and they feel absolutely trapped. He's taking her to the train. They've talked several times about having a ride down a sled, I think we call it in the Midwest. And this becomes for them the last thing they can do together. They take one ride down the hill. They come up, and then the question is raised, shall we do it a second time? And Maddie says, I want to die. Effectively, she says, I want you to run the sleigh into the tree, and then we'll be together forever. And Ethan says, okay, I want you to sit behind me, and I'll be on the front of this. And I think he wants to hit the tree first.
Yeah.
He starts going down the hill, and this is what we get. They're going faster and faster, approaching the elm, and the narrator says, suddenly, his wife's face, with twisted, monstrous lineaments, thrust itself between him and his goal, and he made an instinctive movement to brush it aside. And instead of having a head-on collision, I assume they hit to one side, and they are both crippled in one way or another for the rest of their lives
but
that they live.
Addie takes the brunt of it.
Yeah, it's worse for her.
It's way worse for her. There's a horrible description about he thinks he hears a mouse cheeping under the snow, and then he realizes that it's her, and that her the noises are being made from her suffering.
There's interesting moments when Zena is a lot like a witch. She's interested in these medicines, which are like potions. She has instinctive understandings of other people. And I take it that the fact that her face comes to him just at the moment when there might have been this suicide slash liberation and causes him to flinch is like a kind of hex. I think it fits with the New England setting where witchcraft, witchery, is very much a part of the cultural tradition.
But, you know, the landscape is certainly part of the novel. Yeah. That pickle dish. Let's talk about the pickle dish, Meredith.
Well, one of the things I asked my students when I was teaching this text recently is a pickle dish ever just a pickle dish? And their response was no. but the reason this comes up is that when Zena's out of town getting a medical treatment.
And she goes out of town deliberately to taunt him.
Absolutely, yeah. And Maddie sets up this little dinner, which sort of seems like a little presage of what would be to come if Maddie and Ethan were to have a life together. And she's taken Zena's pickle dish to arrange the table.
She wants it to look pretty.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the cat jumps up and smashes it. And so what happens is that Ethan takes the pieces, arranges them as if it were whole, and puts it back up on the high shelf where Zena put it. So on the one hand, this seems like a kind of avoidant, behavior.
Wish
on
he had
Ethan's
had
part.
Super glue or something.
he goes down to town.
There's no glue. But it's also worth thinking about again why Maddie takes it. Maddie again, who seems like a slip of a girl. It's hard to think she would imagine to get this. But so she is usurping some of Zena's property there. And part of why Zena's so upset, it was a symbol of her marriage to Ethan and a time when she was happy.
And a pretty thing, whereas they have so little. Yeah. They have so little.
Her line is, I tried to keep my things where you couldn't get at them. She says this at the moment when she's accusing Maddie of taking her thing. I think this thingness is important to the novel, too. It's related to the whole question of money and how little money any of them have. Mm-hmm. And so things become very important for Zena, and obviously, I think for Ethan and for Maddie, they're not.
John Fordrecher, he's professor of English at Georgetown University, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Going to open the phones, 800-433-8850, to Shade, Ohio. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning, Diane. So nice to be on your show. I was so happy when you came to Athens, Ohio a few years ago.
Thank you.
Anyway, I have used this book when I've taught like an American dialects class, and I do a segment on literary dialect. And the thing that I find so fascinating, because I look at all the dialogue spoken by the characters and I analyze it. And Edith Wharton basically has Maddie and Ethan speaking pretty much standard English, but then she reverts to more of a New England dialect when she has Zena speak. So Zena, instead of saying have, she goes You know, should have done that instead of should have done that. And she doesn't, and then she employs something called I dialect, where she'll spell a word like catch. Instead of C-A-T-H-E, she spells it K-E-T-C-H, which is, there's nothing phonologically different between K-E and C-A, but it makes her appear ignorant. That's a literary device.
Interesting.
Yeah, I can definitely see her doing that. I think Wharton was an excellent listener. And when she was traveling around New England, that's one of the things she was doing. She was observing and listening. And I think it makes perfect sense that she would be not only picking up on the nuances of different people's speech, but also using them to reflect certain things about the characters. And in this case, it sounds like Ethan and Maddie might seem a little more, I don't know, civilized, you know?
Yeah.
More universal, accessible to the reader.
That's right.
I think we should point out that there are moments in this novel when Ethan really believes he can run away with Maddie. And then he begins to consider not only the practicality of that life, but also how would Zena be taken care of?
And who would take care of Zena? I mean, there isn't anyone else besides him to do that. And that's what's so stark. And by the way, you also brought up setting here, Diane, and
yeah.
that is this stark, cold, wintry,
yeah.
barren, relentless deprivation.
And deprivation somehow, especially because he goes to a neighbor and asks for money, asks for a loan up front on the basis of work that's yet to be done. He is refused. He then thinks, I'll go back again. I'll ask him in a different way, and this time it'll work. And then with Maddie, on the spur of the moment, they decide to commit suicide. What a story.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to take a short break here. We've got lots of callers waiting. We'll come back to them after a short break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we begin a holiday week series featuring a few of our favorite interviews of the year. On day one, it's our interviews with Joan Rivers and Aziz Ansari. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Talking during the break about that film, and as I recall, it was not a film made in Hollywood. Rather, it was made for CBS television as part of its Playhouse 90 series. Julie Harris played Maddie Silver alongside Sterling Hayden, and Clarice Blackburn played Zena Frome. I can still see it. All right, let's go back to the phones to Bobby in Alexandria, Virginia. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Go right ahead.
Well, I was just commenting on how I had to read Ethan Frome amongst, you know, the other greats. Atlas Shrugged in AP English Lit class junior year in high school. And he was one of the few PhD teachers for the whole school. So he was very, he was going to make sure that we knew that. And instead of really discussing it like normal English classes as part of a daily curriculum, we got ready for the AP exam during the day, and we were expected to read the book on our own. And at the end of each month, we got like these grueling texts with details about each month's book. And I remember the exam for Ethan Frome and how just littered with these itty-bitty details, but I will never forget. And I always associate with it since then these highlights of color that he specifically drew questions to that were both against the bleak physical environment and the bleak emotional environment both. For instance, the red scarf, it's very much drawn attention to in the language of the book when I think they're about to fly down the hill for the very last time.
Quite right. A red scarf, red ribbon.
Red mm-hmm. ribbon. I think it's the first evening when Ethan's taking Maddie home from the dance. He fantasizes about rubbing the scarf against his cheek.
Yes.
And I think that's another wonderful moment of that sort of struggle for communication that you're talking about, that this is the only connection he can imagine himself feeling.
And the pickle dish is red.
Right. Yes.
And red is the color of life amongst all this stark,
of
cold, white, gray. Mm-hmm.
John, have you taught this
No,
book?
I haven't. Uh-uh.
You've never
no.
taught it. Uh-uh. And the reason I ask, both because of what Bobby said and now an email from Virginia in Michigan, she says, my high school-age granddaughter, who's a voracious reader, who loves almost everything she reads, hated Ethan Frome. Should this book be on high school reading lists? What do you think, John?
I want to answer that by raising a kind of a parallel question. I think that Edith Wharton wanted to write a tragedy. She refers to Ethan Frome on the first pages as tragic. And the question that forms in my mind, and maybe the reason why the early reviewers that you mentioned at the beginning of the show, Diane, didn't like it a whole lot. Usually tragedies end in some kind of recognition that a terrible mistake has been made on the part of the tragic hero. And then there is, for the audience or the reader, some kind of purgation, some kind of relief by, as Aristotle tells us, fear and pity that causes the tensions of the piece to go away from us, to drain out. But Wharton's novel doesn't give us that kind of an escape, I don't think. And the last scene, which we're going to talk about a bit more, in fact intensifies our sense of their sort of endless suffering in a
endless
kind of prison.
Tragedy.
So it's got the elements of a tragedy, but it doesn't have the release that we often have at the ends of tragedy. And I think that must bother some kids and adults too.
Especially young people who are looking forward to life, who see life as unending good things happening, Meredith.
I think part of this goes back to Wharton's status as a realist, that she's not someone who's going to give the reader the satisfaction of a romantic suicide, essentially. And I think a botched suicide pact is evidence of that. People have to live with the consequences of what they've done.
You talked a lot about repression, too, Diane, and restriction is sort of the theme, and they just get more and more restricted by the end, and that's very hard. It's very hard for the reader.
And, of course, I think we should talk about how all of this ends after the attempted suicide, which, you know, for their sake, you almost hope is
yes.
the end.
Right.
It's worse.
It's worse.
Absolutely.
It's worse. Maddie undergoes some kind of a horrific transformation so that when we see her at the end of the novel, in the conclusion, we see her bloodless and shriveled. Her dark eyes had the bright, witch-like stare that disease of the spine sometimes gives. And this business of blood, we've talked about red being associated with Maddie. Earlier, when the two are so desperately in love, Ethan feels that her blood is in his veins. And now at the end, she is bloodless and shriveled. He drags his crippled, semi-crippled right side, his leg and his arm, around, trying to make enough money just to support the family. And then Zena is, as we said, the caregiver, but reluctant, resentful caregiver. And the three of them are locked in this farmhouse kitchen all winter long. And we've talked about the importance of the weather symbolically. The two lovers had this one moment in a summertime when they sat by a pond and Ethan found Maddie's locket. But for the rest, it's almost always in a cold, frozen moment. And let me just add, the afternoon of the sledding, it's starting to thaw. And they go down, and then, of course, there's the collision and the lifelong crippling.
Ugh. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine.
I was calling to agree with the point about teenagers not reading this kind of literature. I don't think Dickens, I don't think most of the great literature should be read because it is too depressing. I'm a writer, but I'm not going to let any of it be published until I'm dead because it would depress my children. They would think I'm suicidal. But I think writers just take great pleasure in writing about tragedy. They relish it. They derive energy from it, but to the young reader, it's very upsetting. I think one has to be 40 or 50 to grasp the depth of some of these emotions that women like her were able to capture.
You know, the same has been said about Shakespeare, that people shouldn't read it until they're 40 or so. They don't have the wherewithal to understand it, yet we see all kinds of mayhem in Shakespeare that is certainly taught junior high, high school, college. I mean,
not to mention all the tragedy that's on television.
Well, precisely. Thank you very much, Lisa. Okay, let's go to Long Island, New York. Good morning, Vincent.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
I had a chance to read this book, like a few other calls that mentioned when I was in high school, and I hated it because it was depressing, and I couldn't relate to it. You're a 15-year-old kid, you have no idea. But when I was an adult, and you have a few experiences with relationships, and they go south, you get a better appreciation for the book. And I never really liked how it ended, so I even went so far as to rewrite the ending to make it a little happier. And
tell me how it turned out in your version.
In my version, the only solution I could think of that the two of them could be together is if Zena unfortunately passed away, and the two of them they sold the farm. And Ethan had mentioned a while back he had gotten a job as an engineer in Florida. I finished it where they sold everything. They moved there, but before they left, Ethan saw the cat in the window. He turned to it and said to himself, "Never again." and they left happy.
Wow, that's really quite something. I love it.
I love it too. But I think part of the issue is this takes Ethan being a different kind of person than we've seen Ethan to be. I mean, when he fantasizes running away, and we even see an example of a man who did run away with a woman he loved and they have a beautiful child, he just says, well, I can't put Zena in that position. Realistically, men left their wives. He could put Zena in that position. So to one extent, he's honorable, but to one extent, he's, I think, resistant to change. I mean, this is Starkfield. People are locked in a certain way of living.
He's resistant to change, but he doesn't have a dime to his name. Right. And that's the other part. I mean, how's he going to do this? How's he even going to find train fare? He didn't even have train fare for Maddie. Yeah. So it's tough. Vincent, you're very creative. I love it. Let's take a call from Kathy here in Washington, D.C. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I could call this show 9 times out of 10 on any
I'm so glad. Thank you.
Just in reference to these recent callers, and I'm a parent of 2 middle school-aged daughters who are good students, I agree that things get read too early, and I think that's a shame. But I don't think it's because it's too depressing. It's because you do need life experience to have encountered some of these issues. And unlike Shakespeare, where you can read it on different levels, it's very hard to do that with things like The Scarlet Letter and Ethan Frome and some of the really great works of American and English language literature. And I'm just wondering, does the panel have any suggestions as to how to keep these things alive without foisting them on adolescents who really get turned off by them? I also think, while the world's not going to heck in a handbasket across the board educationally, a lot of literature today is sort of a deus ex machina phenomenon, and kids really aren't able to deal with themes like being trapped in your own values, being trapped by the interaction between society and your own values, and all of these things that really are the nuts and bolts of adult life.
Lisa.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I have to disagree with the caller. I think that exposure to literature, beginning at a very early age, even difficult literature, sets up a life where you understand it and you seek it out. Whereas if you don't get exposed to literature at an early age, difficult literature, literature that isn't all happy endings, you have no foundation.
Kathy mentioned The Scarlet Letter. There is so much learning in The Scarlet Letter.
And obviously people who construct curricula see that for many of the students that they work with, this is their last chance to get these books into the hands of young people. And so there's this sense that we've got to somehow give them a bit. And notice the sense of I give. Huh?
John Ford Drescher of Georgetown University, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We do seem to have reached a point in teaching where we're sanitizing so much and trying to make the world into a place that it isn't.
And I think the thing is, Ethan Frome may seem like it's distant because it's a different historical moment, it's older people, but I think the feeling of entrapment is something that, you know, lots of young people can relate to. And I mean, you could ask the students, can you imagine what it's like to be closeted, you know? Can you imagine what it's like to not be able to communicate something that's extremely important to you?
And can you imagine being trapped in life where you have no options?
I mean, right.
That seems to me something that could easily be understood. Let's go to Knoxville, Tennessee. Good morning, Betsy.
Good morning. I was glad the conversation took this turn, because as a parent, I would really hate my children's teachers to take the curriculum to not reading challenging literature and to not imagine that they won't reread some of these challenging works as lifelong learners, but my children have been watching Shakespeare since they were four. They've appeared in Shakespeare productions, and they get this challenging literature. They love Charles Dickens. It would be so sad if we eliminated the challenging, difficult, and sad stories of Oedipus or Macbeth or any of these other things out of their curriculum.
How about Ulysses?
Yeah.
Not easy stuff. Here's a wonderful email from Lisa in Texas. She says, my sophomore high school English teacher not only had us read Ethan Frome, but read every word aloud. Mm. It was one of the best literary experiences I've ever had. I adore the book. I believe plenty of young people are mature enough to grasp the subject matter and the literary genius of the language. I should mention that our teacher dealt with the issue of the tragic ending by assigning us to write our own alternative endings.
Wow.
Isn't that marvelous?
That is.
Yeah. What a great
You know, when
way
you hear
teach.
The experience of these callers, the one woman who was just given drills in details that are for tests, and then this most recent account... and in a sense, here's one answer to the question we're talking about. Excellent teaching can take difficult texts mm-hmm. and make them come alive for students. And as you're saying, Lisa, help people to grow through the texts.
Of course. John Ford Drescher, professor of English at Georgetown University. Lisa Page, who's president of the Penn Faulkner Foundation. Meredith Goldsmith, she's professor of English at Ursinus College, vice president of the Edith Wharton Society. Thank you all so much. I love this discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We do too.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Ally Bank,